507, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. It's always good to see you guys. It's an interesting month so far. We've got some conflicting information, being that this is now the 13th day of August when we're recording this show. Looking at the NTSB website, they're working on 39 accidents and incidents that at least have been reported to them that they're putting numbers to conduct an investigation. I have a sneaky suspicion that those numbers are even higher, maybe even in the FAA database, because what doesn't get reported to the NTSB or the board doesn't take on with a number to investigate, the events are still reportable. And I get a feeling those numbers are higher. The reason I bring this up is because I happen to be talking to a friend of mine who owns a large aircraft recovery and salvage yard. And she was saying, at least in the Northeast, that it's been a slow summer. They've only picked up two wrecked airplanes. And it's like, I don't know what you were looking at. I was making fun of her. I said, but, you know, they're crashing every single day. And in fact, the day we are recording this podcast and YouTube video, there happened to be an accident this morning in Ohio. So, again, I'm wondering if not only it's not necessarily seasonal, but it is maybe regional, of the amount of flying. We know that coming off of Oshkosh in the central part of the United States, people either going to Oshkosh or then departing Oshkosh and going back to their home state, we had a lot of accidents and incidents in that period of time. But the first 12 days of August, where we have at least 39 or now 40 reportable events, seems extraordinarily high. And I know, Todd, that you looked at some data and picked up a couple of accidents that we're going to talk about. I was looking at one accident in particular, John, that was up in Rochester, and it involved an airplane almost to the vintage that you learned to fly. It was a J-5. I think you learned on the Wright flyer, but, you know, it's the next iteration from the Wright flyer. But, you know, in reading the prelim, because the final report isn't out, the fact is that you got an airplane that was sitting basically in a barn-type hangar at a private airstrip, hadn't flown in a while, according to the owner, and there were a bunch of mud dauber, bugs and stuff all over it. So they wipe them all off. Don't know the extent of what they did to ensure that all of the mud daubers and any other bugs that may have found a home on that airplane were removed. But according to the NTSB prelim, and this was a fatal accident because the passenger eventually was killed and the pilot was seriously injured, but they did get some information from the pilot, who said, yeah, we cleaned off the airplane, we took off, we flew 20 miles, we put 6 gallons of fuel in the airplane that basically put the airplane at full tanks. They took off, were returning back, and during the return flight, the engine started surging sufficiently and then eventually stopped operating. pilot tried to put it down on a road and unfortunately struck the top of a tree, which pitched that airplane and went straight into the pavement. And it was interesting the way it was characterized in the prelim, because the investigator said that the six bolts that hold the propeller to the crankshaft had embedded into the pavement at least an inch. So that airplane went straight down after it hit the tree, struck the ground. And those kinds of accidents, John, usually result in serious injury and fatalities just because that vertical energy is, you know, straight down. But
it's usually head injuries.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people often that if I went back flying again, I'd be wearing a helmet. It's just so easy to hit your head. But you know what this sounds like to me? And let me back up. I happen to spend a lot of time in the summer in western Massachusetts, southern Vermont, and northeastern New York. And I have a habit, if I see a sign that says airport, I go look at what kind of airport it is. Right? And I might look on the map, maybe, maybe not. And I go in, and if I see a J2 or J3, I'm always going over to them to look at them and looking at these airplanes. These little airports, there's no security. You can go right up to them if they have a T-hanger. You can go right up to the T-hanger, or if most of them are outside, and I look at them, and I see them in various stages of neglect. And I see the bugs making homes in some of the offices of the airplane, including the pitot tubes. Right, so it's not uncommon up here. And they sit sometimes for a long time. I have gone back to airports 2 years after my previous visit, and that same airplane sitting in the same location. Right, so they're not being touched. Well, that leads to a lot of problems, as both of you know, included contaminated fuel and also debris settling the tank. And what this sounds to me like, that they had debris that settled in the bottom of the tank, but because of the varnish, it was probably semi-firm. And they ran the fuel down in the tank to get to their whatever airport this was, and they filled it up. When they filled it up, they agitated the tank. And now they have all this, some of this debris floating around in the fuel that they just put in, and now they're flying back and it's getting sucked into the carburetor. Because it ran fine going out. So that tells me the engine was fine. The carburetor was okay. It didn't get all varnished up. And something else had to happen. Well, what happened in the intern, right? Pumping fuel from a gas nozzle. So that's going to agitate the fuel and agitate everything in the tank.
Yeah.
And now you can suspend it, have it floating around in the fuel gets sucked into the carburetor, and there comes a clog.
And you bring up a good point, John, because the NTSB, when they did do their investigation, given the fact that the pilot had said that they had to clean mud daubers out and everything else, they did blow air through the fuel lines and they were all clear, so there was nothing obstructing the fuel lines. The carburetor was significantly damaged in the impact, and that's kind of obvious since the airplane hit basically straight down, nose first, engine first. They don't talk about any kind of fuel sample other than they found debris in the gascolator. They found dirt and debris in the gascolator. And I'm wondering, because they don't talk about whether or not the pilot did any kind of pre-flight to determine if there was any water in that fuel, because we don't know what kind of pre-flight they did prior to taking off on the first leg of that trip or that flight. It's obvious, like you said, that apparently it was operating apparently normal. But again, you put new fuel in, you agitate it. Next thing you know, you've stirred up all that debris. It gets sucked in and now you got problems. The big thing that I do it all the time. I don't care if the airplane's been sitting, you know, an hour or a week or a month. I always rock the wings on the ground, because I want to agitate those tanks to either migrate the water to the fuel sumps that are at the root of the wing, or any kind of debris. And again, you have to really understand and know your airplane. The Mooney is notorious for trapping water. Other airplanes with wet wings are notorious for trapping water. And the reason for it, John, is that whenever there's a fuel leak on these general aviation airplanes, the mechanic goes in and uses, you know, goopy putty to run a seam around the inside of the tank. And of course, that'll seal it. The problem is they cover the lightning holes that are on the in the base of those ribs that allows the water and stuff to migrate inboard. So now you've trapped water in the various bays, like on the Mooney, you can trap water all the way out to the wingtip in these various bays. And the only way it gets migrating to the wing route is by agitation. Either you rock the wings on the ground, or when you're in flight, of course, the turbulence or bumping around as you're taxiing to the runway. Next thing you know, the water is migrating and you suck, you know, a slug of water that you thought you had good fuel when you sumped the tank, but now you really got water in it. You have to understand your airplane, and you really have to do what you were talking about, John, and that is really know that, hey, you know, think about this logically. The airplane's been sitting a while. I just cleaned off all these bugs. But in the Northeast, because this was up in Rochester, you know, the airplane's sitting, you know that heat cycles over a period of time are going to create moisture in the tank. And it's obvious that these tanks weren't full. I always park my airplane with full tanks to reduce or mitigate the fuel contamination by water that forms from humidity in the tank itself. I mean, these are the practices that as pilots and owners you wanna do. But, you know, again, you got to think about the fact that there's garbage in these tanks. Any airplane, I don't care how pristine you try to keep your airplane, you're always going to find something in there. It's introduced either during the fueling, or you open up the cap and there was a little bit of debris that had blown on the wing and it got around the fuel cap and it gets into the tank. There's always something. And I know that you're always preaching at the end of our show about pre-flight. And again, you got to use some logic here. You got to use a little bit of, you know, caution when, okay, yeah, the airplane's been sitting for a month or two. Maybe I got to do just a little extra to ensure that I don't have stuff in the fuel system.
You know, you talk about logic and what people should do, right? So as you were talking about things that are going on, I'm just holding up a piece of paper here. I know you can't see it, but that's 1 month's worth of stuff that I collected off the internet, out of newspaper articles, about things like taxied into the fuel farm fence, taxis into the fuel farm fuel dispenser, started the engine with the tow bar attached. I mean, the list goes on and on. And we're going to do a show about all this. That's why I'm collecting it. The point is, the pilots that we have today, and some of them are seasoned, but too many pilots today are too quick, and they're not using any common sense whatsoever. When I first started in this business with the Wright brothers, before you say it, I worked in a shop that had an interesting fuel pump. Right, it was a centrifugal pump, not the typical piston pump that we have. It had a pretty good sized nozzle on it. It spun up really well, and you sucked the tank dry, not only for the fuel, but it would be like a vacuum cleaner in the bottom of the tanks. Now, we use it on wet wings sometimes, but that's where it wasn't designed for. It was designed for the smaller 140, the Cubs, the airplanes that had the single fuel tank either over your head in the wing where the wings come together, or in front of you between the engine and you, where you had a decent sized nozzle and you can get in there and you can clean up all the debris. And it did a good job of that. Today, you can't do that in many of the airplanes. So you've got to really pay attention, or you're going to spend a fortune stripping, you know, the airplane open so you can get into it. It's interesting times, but we got to have common sense in our pilots. They got to understand that sometimes putting an airplane back in the air after it sat for a long period of time is not the job for a pilot. You bought an airplane that sat around for 3 or 4 years and you essentially had a mechanic with you the entire time putting it together. Thank God it wasn't me.
Yeah, because this airplane doesn't have bicycle chains.
My favorite kind of propeller.
That's it. Well, this is a perfect segue, John, because when we talk about common sense, Todd, this accident that we're going to talk about involving an air tractor, It's obvious this pilot didn't have any common sense because he tried to do something with this airplane, and based on his very limited qualifications and experience, that defies common sense. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, first, let me explain my very sophisticated methodology for finding events on the NTSB website for us to talk about. I thought, let me find the most recent report that's a final report that has a public docket, because if there's anything useful in there, we can chew on the report, chew on the public docket. And this is a report of an event that happened in April of this year, of 2025. The report was released yesterday, August 12, 2025. I thought, okay, can't get more frequent, more recent than that. The bottom line is there is an air tractor, a firebomber aircraft, float-equipped agricultural plane. And you can see the picture of the accident aircraft here if you're watching the video version of this. It was on a delivery, apparently, it didn't state so, but it seems to be a delivery flight from the States over to Portugal. The aircraft only had about 25 hours on it, brand new aircraft, and they're going across the ocean, they meaning the single pilot. The pilot took off from St. John's, Newfoundland. Roughly 20 minutes later, the aircraft experienced icing. So icing over the ocean, in my view, I'm not an expert pilot. I don't even have my instrument yet. But it's like, well, gee, if I'm in an aircraft that does not have anti-icing or de-icing equipment like the Cessna I fly, A, number one, I'm going to avoid icing whenever possible. Number two, if I even get a hint of icing, I'm going to take immediate action. Well, in this case, the pilot's immediate action was to continue flying toward Europe. The icing happened about 21 minutes in. Apparently, the icing increased. I say apparently because the investigation wasn't really clear on that. And about 50 minutes later, after making a 180-degree turn, the aircraft crashed into the ocean. They did recover a pontoon. They recovered some other equipment. But interestingly, the NTSB had this as a probable cause. The National Transportation Safety Board determines the probable causes of this accident to be the airplane's impact with the ocean for undetermined reasons based on the available evidence. I sat back and I said to myself, I'm not an expert investigator, not like my colleagues here. And given that we have an event where there was ADS-B tracking, there was a flight plan, there was weather information up and down that area of Canada ahead of time, and there was icing reported by the pilot, and the airplane crashed. Why is this not enough information for the NTSB to go a little bit beyond, gee, it crashed and we don't know why?
Yeah, well, you bring up several points here. Let's start with the pilot. From reading the prelim, it's indicative that he did hold a single-engine land, a single-engine sea, and a multi-engine land private pilot certificate with those specific ratings. But the NTSB report says he didn't hold an instrument rating. Right there, that's a major red flag. You're not going to do a crossing without getting into some type of instrument condition. I mean, I don't care, you know, what day of the week, what year it is, doesn't matter. You always have the probability, the high probability of finding yourself in some sort of IMC condition. And now you got a non-instrument rated private pilot, which again, here's a problem. If he is ferrying that airplane, that's money. And if he is taking compensation, he's not qualified to be compensated for that flight. That's just, you know, reading this report that you provided, Todd. Then you look at the airplane. Yes, it's float equipped. Yes, it's a turbine powered airplane. And he's making the crossing. He gets into icing conditions. This isn't just the fact that the airplane is icing up, but now you got these big floats, these pontoons hanging below. You've got all sorts of exposure to ice. And that ice is going to create weight. The airplane isn't going to be able to stay in the air. And now the pilot's got to deal with that. But it's obvious that if he got into icing, he was an IMC. Now the question is, since he didn't hold an instrument rating, I can't remember. Do you remember if he filed an IFR flight plan? I think.
I could not see anything in the report that stated that or in the public docket.
Yeah. The question is, what kind of weather briefing did he do? Did he get a verbal weather briefing through an automated or through a weather source? Did he do it on his iPad through one of the various apps? What kind of weather briefing that he thought he could do this flight VFR? That in and of itself is a problem. And then, of course, in the aircraft registry, it doesn't show anything being registered for this N number, yet we know that the airplane was flying. The NTSB had a representative from Air Tractor as a party to the investigation. Where's all that documentation to talk about, you know, did this guy have, I mean, the report says that he had 1.2 hours total time. Well, we know that that's a misstatement by the NTSB. He had to have more than 1.2 hours. You need to have, you know, 40 or more just to get a private pilot certificate. So, again, they were very sloppy in putting this report together because they didn't develop all of the factual information. What kind of crossing experience did this pilot have? Did he try? Is this the first time he's doing it? Is he very familiar with it? Did he watch, you know, a YouTube channel on how to cross the Atlantic Ocean? I mean, what kind of experience? What kind of equipment did he have on the aircraft for survival? Was he wearing a survival suit? I mean, there's just a thousand different questions that there are no answers to that should have been developed by the investigator, even though the airplane crashed off the coast of Canada. The NTSB can use their Canadian counterparts to help develop these facts, conditions, and circumstances. And John, you know, reading through this report, it was just sloppy. It was just one of those, you know, proverbial kick the tires, light the fire, let's get out of here. It was, you know, throw some stuff on a piece of paper and get it off my desk.
It's not like this thing sat around for 2 years. Nothing was done with it, and let's get rid of it.
It sat around for 5 months, and that's it.
Right. It didn't have whiskers yet.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
What's the best part of this job?
I would say just the amount of knowledge that I've been able to gather kind of about the GA industry in general. In the time that I've worked here, I feel like I've learned so much just from speaking with people on the phone, doing my everyday tasks in my job. We were able to do a ground school with a local CFI, which was super insightful. We went through the whole 9 hours. I felt like I've learned so much.
Have you had an opportunity to fly the simulator you have here in the office?
Yes, I flew. I want to say we did at least 2 hours, I think, and then crashed, did some successful takeoffs and landings.
That's a good
the local pattern. So it was very cool to kind of get some insight into what our customers are doing, you know, on a day-to-day basis, the training they're doing.
So with that knowledge, did that give you a better understanding when you're talking to a prospective client?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, what their needs are?
Yes. I feel a lot more confident speaking to people because I kind of understand where they're coming from, the types of aircraft they're discussing, the types of training that we're discussing in terms of, you know, getting training discounts on there, asking, you know, have you got your private certificate? Have you completed the ground school portion? What have you done? So that's been, I would say, very helpful.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
The question is, this airplane, based on the way the factual is written, pilot got into icing, requested a higher altitude, or at least tried to climb to a higher altitude, and then sometime later got into a 2,000 foot per minute rated descent for whatever reason. It's not clear why. We don't know if it was a controlled descent or an uncontrolled, and the pilot was just trying to keep the wings level. He had no choice but to let the airplane descend because of possibly an accumulation of ice or whatever. But he's going to land on the ocean. He's got floats. What happened there? Given the fact that the airplane can land on water, did he screw up the landing? Did he not know that the water was there and he flew the aircraft into the water? Because, again, the NTSB report, while cryptic, indicates that the weather conditions at the accident site were IMC. So does that mean he just got into a controlled descent and next thing you know, he ends up flying the aircraft into the water? I mean, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and yes, there are a lot of unknowns. The fact is that based on the information that they've at least presented in this report, you got an unqualified pilot trying to do something beyond not only his experience, but possibly the experience or the capabilities of the airplane. That's an issue in and of itself. Are there lessons to be learned? You better believe it. There's more investigation that should have been done because, again, every accident has a lesson learned. Every accident, even an intentional act, has lessons to be learned. And, you know, I've talked to you guys about it. I preach about it all the time. There are three probable causes. There's the obvious cause, the political cause, and root cause. A lot of these accidents that we dissect on our shows and we talk about, the investigators have gone to obvious cause. Well, the airplane crashed. Don't know why, but it crashed. Well, guess what? Didn't need to leave the office to figure that out. I mean, we know that. The question is why. And even if you can't determine with a high level of confidence or accuracy based on information, we've just talked about possible scenarios, inexperience, flying in the aircraft into the water because of the weather conditions, icing conditions that prevented the airplane or the pilot from being able to maintain, you know, altitude control. We can go on and on and on. Where are all these things talked about in the report? They aren't. We don't know, and we're done with it. Get it off my desk. That's not the way accident investigation works. We all shoot, or technically we should all be shooting for root cause. But John, we've seen it over and over and over again, the obvious cause. Airplane hit a power line, killed four people. You know, pilot, you know, failed to see and avoid the power line. Yeah, that's great. Why? Give me the reasons why. That's accident investigation. Political cause, you and I have talked about this, and I will assert that there are some accidents, including one involving a person going out to Martha's Vineyard in a Piper Saratoga with his wife and his sister-in-law. You know, that probable cause statement should have been a lot more detailed than it was. But for some politics, it got to be a vanilla probable cause about suffering the effects of spatial disorientation.
Are you implying that this pilot was somehow related to a famed U.S. politician?
The accident going out to the Nantucket Martha's Vineyard area? Yes.
Gee, I wonder who hangs out in Martha's Vineyard. Anyway, let's go back to this accident. I have a question for you. I want to ask you if this accident actually adhered to the requirements they had for this. This is called a Class 4 accident. It's in the report. If you go to the NTSB website, they give you a definition of what a Class 4 investigation seeks to identify with respect to the cause of the accident. And it says on the second bullet point, for those of you watching the video, Class 4 investigations are limited in scope and of the shortest duration. A final report will be made available to the public that identifies probable cause or causes following board approval and within 6 months. That actually happened. The accident happened, I believe, April 29th. The report was released August 12th of the same year. The report only examines the actions and conditions directly relating to the accident, and the documented sequence of events and probable cause reached is simple and straightforward. Okay, the last part I agree with. The probable cause statement was simple and straightforward. The first part of that sentence examines the actions and conditions directly relating to the accident. Do you believe, the two of you believe, that this report adhered to that part of their own requirements?
Not only no, but hell no.
Yeah. You know, there's another piece to this puzzle. That part four that you're talking about, it's been in there a long time. It was rarely used. It's used more today, and I think at least in part it's used today, because of the lack of resources at the NTSB. A lot of young, new people, they're young, most of them, that's not holding that against them. Their experience level is low, so every investigation takes longer, which means it's using up more resources. They don't have an unlimited supply of resources. You know, we can have a lot of discussions over did they squander what they had or whatever. Just as an aside, we'll keep that for another discussion. Right now, we know they don't have the resources to do the job that they've been asked to do.
Well, let's just be careful with that, John. They have the manpower because they do less accidents than 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago when I, you know, went to work there. We did a hell of a lot more accidents. They have more investigators. They do less accidents. And the whole purpose of being very discriminatory about the accidents that they did investigate, according to all the previous chairmen that started this little program, was that they wanted to spend more time delving into the detailed issues of these accidents so that they could make more recommendations. But again, they aren't holding that end of the stick up, because even on the accidents that we've dissected on this show that are fatal, where we see that there were issues that would lead to safety recommendations or changes to enhance aviation safety, they've glossed over and they've gone to that methodology that that Todd was talking about. It's a very cryptic, very simplistic probable cause. Loss of control for unknown reasons. Loss of control, you know, pilot in-flight collision with terrain. Okay, great. That tells me the obvious, but it doesn't tell me why. And oh, by the way, you said you were going to spend more time trying to figure these things out to enhance aviation safety. And they don't do that.
And the one that drove me crazy forever and ever, still going on, is when they have a maintenance problem and they bring the probable cause right up to the hangar doors, but they don't go inside. And,
yeah.
And as a result, we don't get that detailed look at the flaws within the maintenance department that drive change within the maintenance department.
And what I'm going to be interested is, because now the NTSB, their criteria, their change of focus for hiring investigators is more on your side and getting away from the ops side. Well, that's a delicate balance there, because you can't have a private pilot who doesn't have a multi-engine rating as an investigator and has all the AMP credentials and manufacturer's credentials go out and investigate a Cessna 310 shooting an approach at night, an RNAV approach or a GPS approach, if they don't understand how to shoot an RNAV approach or GPS approach in a multi-engine airplane. So, I mean, it's a delicate balance there. And those types of accidents may require two investigators, one that's ops-oriented, while the other one is maintenance-oriented, just for these very reasons. We're going to get these kinds of very simplistic probable causes and, you know, again, cryptic-type reports. Nothing wrong with the airplane. Okay, great. How many times have we seen that? And then, unfortunately, you and I and Todd look through the report. We start asking questions. What about this? What about that? Next thing you know, it pans out that there was something wrong with the airplane.
Well, let me get back to this report for one more question. I mentioned the name of the investigator in charge to the two of you. And, John, I believe you said that, oh, yeah, you know this person. He's like the manager. So presumably this is someone with experience doing investigations. And yet,
he's been with the board a long time, yes.
And, you know, one of the basic things I saw on the public docket was there was a graphical area forecast for weather in that part of the Atlantic from the Canadian weather authorities. And no mention was made of this, whether or not the forecast available to the accident pilot would have given this pilot some insight into whether or not icing was there or not. Icing was mentioned in the report, but no context. It's like, answer the question. Why would somebody take off into known icing events? Perhaps explain whether or not the weather forecast and the weather at the time of the flight was sufficient for that accident pilot to know whether or not they were flying into icing conditions.
Look, I can come up with probable cause factors right now. It's obvious that his pre-flight planning was atrocious. It was bad. It was non-existent. You got a guy who's trying to do something that's not qualified to do what he was doing, in a variety of different ways. And based on the fact that the weather that you just talked about, Todd, was evident and apparent and available, it was obvious that the pre-flight planning by the pilot didn't heed that. Because like you said, to blast off into known IMC conditions that contained ice, I mean, I can come up with a probable cause statement just based on that kind of stuff. Pre-flight planning, inadequate or improper or, you know, failed to do. You know, beyond his capabilities or experience, beyond the airplane's capabilities and experience flying it, I can give you a litany of things rather than, you know, the airplane hit the water for unknown reasons.
So we actually had a chance to talk to some of the people at the NTSB when we were at AirVenture. And John, you had extensive conversations with some of the investigators there. What additional message would you give to those people that you personally talked to based on what we talked about here today?
Pay attention to detail. That was the thing we always said, pay attention to detail, that which means you have to look at the issues and then bore down a little bit, at least a little bit, to find out what role they played in the event that you're looking at. When you when you show up at a site, everything is on the table. You got to work things off the table till you get down to what the meat is. Today, we don't see them working that stuff off the table. They're just ignoring it.
John, and it goes beyond that. It's not just those field investigations that these investigators do. Desk investigations, where you don't leave the office, but you're collecting the evidence. And we talk about this all the time, too. We've had fatal accidents where the investigator didn't leave the office. They sent the FAA to go out and collect the data. The FAA is, you know, collecting just the obvious stuff because they got better things to do. And oh, by the way, by their mandate, they're responsible for enforcement and oversight. They don't have time to do the thorough and methodical accident investigation, even though they do get trained to do that. That's not their primary job. But the fact is that if I get information from the FAA, it's my responsibility as the investigator to comb through it and follow up with it. You track down people to talk to. If you have to do post-accident testing, you do it because there are lessons to be learned. There are safety recommendations that are still sitting on the field, as they say in football. You know, we left plays on the field. Well, guess what? You left safety recommendations on the field. Why? Because you didn't dig into it. You didn't take the time. You didn't act as an investigator looking at the details, trying to understand where is the safety value in this investigation rather than, you know, collect the data, come up with some ridiculous, simple, probable cause, and get it off your desk.
I remember going crazy on one accident that I was there, that when the report came in, and I had asked for it because it was a GA report that we don't normally put a lot of focus on, the board members. And but there was one that tickled my fancy, so I asked to see more. And it was substantial ground damage, no fire. Small fire, no real fire. I questioned about, in the report, they said he ran out of fuel. They said, how do we know he ran out of fuel? Well, we asked the arriving police officer if he smelled gas. I lost it on that one.
Look, I've had people go out to an accident site. You know, they go, yep, there was no evidence of fuel in the tanks. There's no evidence of fuel on the ground. Here's the problem. You breach a fuel tank, it's a hot day, or it's an arid, you know, your plane crashed in the dirt. And if there's no grass around for the fuel to burn the grass and kill it, guess what? That fuel gets absorbed into the dirt. You got to take a, you know, a spatula or, you know, a little spade shovel and dig down. I guarantee you're going to find a layer of fuel. I've done that in the dirt. I've done that in the snow. You look in the snow. Is it stained blue? I mean, guess what? You know, yeah, there's no fuel in the fuel tank, but if you look, there's blue snow all around the airplane. You know, things like that. Those are the details. That's the one that, you know, investigators need to be focused on. And a lot of times, because the board has been delegating, and they delegate almost 80% of their on-scene investigations to the FAA, again, the FAA doesn't have time to be doing that kind of work. They got other things to do. They're going to collect what they need to collect. They're going to ship it off to the NTSB and say it's yours. You know, and
it's an additional duty for every inspector. So he's got his normal workload and then they dump this on him.
Yeah.
And you know what bothers me too with a lot of the accidents? They have the other parties to the investigation there. You know, you can't tell me that the Cessna investigator or the engine manufacturer investigator hasn't gathered those facts. They have them.
Yep.
They should be asked about them.
Exactly.
See, right? Right. But
and years ago, we used to put their get their reports and put them in the public docket. Now, for whatever reason, you rarely see a manufacturer's report. What you do see are investigators cutting and pasting out of those manufacturer's report without context into their factual report. And I notice it when I'm going through it, working an accident, where it's like, What the board put in their report is identical to what's in the engine manufacturer's report, except it doesn't have any attribution to the engine manufacturer's report. That is a big no-no, because the board didn't come up with that. The engine manufacturer made those statements.
In fact, when I first got to the board, we had, or just before I got there, we had an investigator let go because of that.
Yeah.
He was using 100% of what the manufacturer's report is as his report.
And that's why we get back to, you got to go out and be an investigator. Do some of that investigator stuff, Mav. It is all about looking to find a reason, not only for the accident, but a reason to generate a safety recommendation and enhance safety. That is the bottom line of being an investigator. What are we going to benefit? How are we going to improve aviation safety or enhance aviation safety through this? It doesn't have to be a tragic, fatal accident to find a safety recommendation in these accidents. Better training, better pre-flight, better whatever. The fact is, there's always a lesson to be learned. Well, I know that we've harped on this, and again, we get very passionate about all of these things. We are very critical of folks in various organizations because this is what they get paid to do, and you can't use the excuse that the workload is too high, the resources aren't there. Guess what? You get paid to be an investigator, and if you're going to be responsible for conducting the investigation, you can pick up the phone. The phone still works. You can make phone calls. You can track witnesses down. You can track information down. You can conduct post-accident testing. Even if you can't be there, you have the FAA counterpart. You send a part to a manufacturer, and you send the FAA over there to oversee it. There are all sorts of ways to do a thorough and methodical investigation. There are no excuses. And the fact is that, again, the business of accident investigation is all about safety enhancement. So with that being said, Todd, I'm going to leave you with our second to the last word.
Well, this time around, my second to the last word is inspired by the actual final report itself. At the end, it has a list of participating persons, including two people from the Transportation Safety Board of Canada, Canada's equivalent of the NTSB. They participated in this investigation, so here's my challenge to the NTSB. Take this final report, send it to those two people at the TSB of Canada, and ask them this one question. What do you think?
I wonder if they didn't do an investigation themselves, separate report, because the airplane did take off from St. John's.
There is another question, John. I mean, again, we can keep going. That then segues into you, John, with our last word.
All right, so this accident clearly has indicated one of the potential problems being poor pre-planning for the flight. So I ask all of you to do your pre-planning twice. Before you leave for the airport, do it at home or the hotel or wherever you are. When you get to the airport, do it again with the latest information. If it's different, find out why. When you go out to the airplane, do a good pre-flight. We still see accidents with pre-flights are involved. I mean, lots of them. And I said on this show once earlier, where we actually had somebody that listened to our show all the time. He's waited for an airplane to come in. The airplane came in with a student and an instructor on it. He went out to the airplane and found one of the brackets on the flight control broken. Thankfully, he went and made the other two come back out and look at it and see that something happened and they missed it, at least presumably.
Yeah.
And when you get out, up in the air, put your head on the swivel, and please pay attention. I mean, we're identifying all kinds of problems. We're going to identify it on the ground. All right. So after you do your pre-flight and you start your airplane up, pay attention to what's going on. You don't want to be taxiing into the fuel farm fence or into the pump or taxiing into the airplanes. We got a lot of those.
Yeah, we've got a lot of accidents like that to talk about.
Yeah, page after that. I mean, I only spent a few days and I got a whole page.
Yeah.
Right. And given how little it's written about, how hard they are to find, there's got to be 3-4 times as many out there that we'll never know about. Oh, please, please, fly safely. Use your head and fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Whether you're a student pilot, CFI, borrowing or building an airplane, or looking to buy, Avemco Insurance Company can help you find the right insurance coverage based on what you fly and how you fly it. No gotchas. No runaround. No confusing language. No middlemen. Avemco Insurance Company values safety and is a proud sponsor of the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety today. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're a Flight Safety Detectives listener.